Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. On the 6th of July, 1989, Ambassador George F. Kennan was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President George Bush. It is the highest civilian award of the government of the United States. The citation which accompanies Ambassador Kennan's medal begins with these words: "Career diplomat, historian, and educator, George Kennan has helped shape American foreign policy since 1933. A scholar and practitioner, George Kennan has set an impeccable standard of service to his nation and society. His is a life of rare achievement, and his contributions continue to be made." Ambassador Kennan, it's an honor to be with you today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be asked to come today.
Thank you very much, sir. That's very gracious. Ambassador Kennan, I've had the pleasure of reading many of the nearly score of books that you've written, and I'd like to indulge my own intellectual curiosity, if I may, sir, just for a moment, because I'm always intrigued by what's at the root of such scholarship, the scholarship that has appeared in your books and which has influenced your diplomacy. And I have a personal sense that there is a confluence of three things that have sort of led to your work, to your life, and to your thought. That in the first instance, it's a question of a fundamental regard for the lessons of history, a commitment to the precepts of Western civilization, and a very well-grounded understanding of the history of this country. Do I have it right, sir?
Well, when it comes to the importance of a knowledge, consciousness of history, you're absolutely correct in what you say. I mentioned before when we were talking, a friend of mine, John Lucas, and the greatest of his books, I think, was a book he wrote on historical consciousness, in which he showed that this has really been basically a European development that hardly exists in other parts of the world. And I think that's tremendously important. And while one must beware of citing, of regarding past situations as identical with ones that we have today and say, well, all we have to do is what we did then. Well, that's never true. The world is always changing. What is not changing are certain basic things in human beings. But otherwise, yes.
I'm struck by this because it seems to me that your understanding that was so valuable to all of us of the Soviet Union and of Russia owes also very powerfully to your understanding of the history of that vast, great, and often very troubled land.
Yes. Well, I wish I were more of a historian in the history of Russia than I am. My life and my interests have been spotty, and they've gone up and down, and I've been asked to do other things too. But I think that it is very valuable to look at the past of Russia when we think of things today. Not that this has absolutely immutable lessons to us, not that we have to do just the same thing someone in the 18th century would have done, but there are certain basic qualities in the culture of both countries which can be helpful to each other, unless they are cultivated in the proper way, they can also be unhelpful.
Well said.
Sometimes.
As we have seen.
Yes. But somehow or other, I've found the Russian experience greatly enriching for myself. Mm-hmm. And I think the reasons why that has been true are ones that would apply to a great number of other people too. Curiously enough, the Russians, with all their failures, their disasters, their horrors, But they have brought forward people who, whose perceptions of life have been of world value.
Oh, yes.
You think of Tolstoy, you think of Dostoevsky. And actually, the one, to my mind, the deeper of all of these men, the deepest of all of them, but it takes a little careful attention to discover it, it was Chekhov.
I agree fully, and I'm going to have to ask you a question about our common devotion to Anton Chekhov. I think you're absolutely right about that. And indeed, I, as one who has an understanding of Russia gained through its literature and its opera, if you will, I agree profoundly with you that they have given us great insight into human nature, not just their own nature, but human nature.
Chekhov was as honest a man as I have ever read about. I couldn't know him personally. He died in the year in which I was born. Mm-hmm. I did, however, once go to talk with his widow, which was very unprofitable because the party and the police long hesitated before they would permit this. And then it was put in a sort of a cell-like room with three chairs, one for her, one for me, and one for the secret police supervisor. And she was terrified. You couldn't get much out of her. I did meet his sister, too. And I learned all I could. I had thought when I was younger of trying to do a biography of him. Well, of course, other people have now done that.
I, in fact, remember reading in Sketches from a Life your stated wish to write that biography and your visit to his familiar sites. And I've always wanted to ask you this question, sir, and there's no better moment than now. Because of that interest in Chekhov and the other great Russian writers, and because, quite frankly, of the own quality of your writing, the quality of your own writing, I must say, and here let me try to do justice to its lyricism. In Sketches from a Life, for example, there are many very poignant passages, descriptions of people, places, and times that are absolutely irreplaceable. I always wondered this. If George Kennan had not chosen to be a diplomat, would he have striven to be a novelist and poet?
Well, that's an interesting question. And strangely enough, if you were to say, what did you have from your years as a government official, 26 years, that helped you later with literature, I would find it very hard to answer that. I tried in the years when I was in government in writing reports for the government in one form or another to put them into respectable and if possible, impressive literary shape. I wasn't the first person who had done that. There had been a number of diplomats from earlier ages whose reports had that quality, Harold Nicholson in England, but there had been others. And somehow or other, the discipline of writing such reports for a government, the restraints you had to place upon yourself, I think this was good for me as a writer. I've never forgotten what Goethe said. I think that it may not have been Goethe, but he said the greatness of the artist is dependent on the restraints he imposes on himself.
I believe that was Goethe, sir.
I think that was
and well said too. And I cannot resist asking, when we talk about writing and one talks with George Kennan, inevitably the question turns one to the X article and your intentions as you wrote that. Because as we all know, as the world knows, that was a document of extraordinary importance to American foreign policy. And it set off in its wake, of course, a concept of containment that may not have been the one that you sought.
No, well, that is, of course, true. And I was to blame for the article had its origin in the fact that in that year, just before General Marshall appeared on the scene and asked me to set up the policy planning staff and to give them an opinion on what he should do about Europe. Just before that, in November or December, I, serving already again in the department, was asked by the Council on Foreign Relations, by the editor of Foreign Affairs, Ham Armstrong, to come up and attend a dinner at the Council and to talk about Russia as I had seen it and our relationship to it, which I did. And Armstrong, who was very, very good at doing this sort of thing, said afterwards, "Have you got that written out anywhere?" And I said, "Well, I don't think I really have, but I'll go back and look at my papers and perhaps I can try to give you the gist of it." So I sat down. It was just at Christmas time and things were very busy. I was very busy. And I pounded it out on a typewriter there in the old War College building, where I guess it was. Yes, I've already been appointed to as to the deputy commandant of the War College at that time, and sent it off to him. And I did make the great mistake of I didn't realize that people would think that there could be containment that was not of a military nature. It was a mixed.
Right.
There were military aspects to it, yes. But it also, I had in mind very much the efforts the Russians were making to penetrate other countries, not just the proletariat, but also the intellectuals.
Mm-hmm.
They were having a certain success with this in England, in France, in Italy, and of course in Germany, where there was still great uncertainty and
right.
People didn't know what to think about. Right?
But, you know, as always, the language is typically canon eloquence. I mean, one phrase where you advocated, quote, "the adroit and vigilant application of counterforce to meet Soviet expansionism."
Yes.
But you didn't mean just
military. No, I meant counter-pressure.
Counter-pressure.
I had in mind that where they were, for example, they were penetrating student organizations, academic ones, quite successfully in some instances. And I thought we really have to oppose that. I had people who agreed with me, and Nicholas Nabokov and others, who thought we have to really meet them on the intellectual level. But that was much, much too cryptic, that statement. It lent itself to misinterpretation.
Well, in the event that misinterpretation took root, and of course, one of the things that happened later was the advent of NATO, and of course, NATO has now celebrated 50 years. NATO has expanded. NATO has recently, as we all know, is currently active in the Balkans. And I wonder your views about that, sir, as NATO's boundaries, so to speak, have come closer to Russia. How do you view that? Has that been a cause of concern?
Well, as you may know, I have, from my memoirs, I never saw a proper reason for setting up NATO in the first place. That was not the problem at that time. So I have always had a certain skepticism about it. There were a great many admirable people connected with it, and people that I have respected and admired. So I don't want to carry that too far. But I think it regrettable that an institution which aspired to be the unifying institution for all of Europe should have been, by its own dedication and its own really charter, a military one rather than a non-military one. I think that Europe's problems were much deeper than just military ones, and particularly after the breakdown of the Soviet government. And I was unable to understand and didn't approve of the expanding in NATO into Eastern Europe. Nobody was threatening anybody at that time. The idea that the Russians were going to invade any of these countries, well, they all had, of course, hang-ups. They remembered the past, but they forgot a great deal about the past too. They don't realize that what brought the Russian power, Stalin's power into Eastern Europe, was really the pursuit of Hitler, of the German forces, into the center of Europe. And we wouldn't have wanted it to be otherwise. We welcomed the advance of the Red Armies into there. The only, we didn't know how to get them out of them once they had gotten in, and that was all very, very bad. But the answer was not fully a military one, and shouldn't have been seen that way. So I've never been very happy about this, and the extension of the boundaries to Eastern Europe. There could have been other ways, I thought, of relieving the anxieties of the Poles and the Hungarians and the Czechs. The other ways that would have been less provocative to the Russians and lend themselves less to misunderstanding.
I think you're absolutely right, sir. And one of the things that you make me mindful of as I sit in your presence is that in the circumstances both of our countries find themselves in now, with a Russia that's in such turmoil, it seems to me that we have to find, and indeed with the current state of tension between our two countries, vis-a-vis the Balkans and so forth, that we really need to find other ways of relating profoundly to Russia, and I would suppose helping them.
Well, I think that's right. And encouraging others to relate to them in a different way. I think I think of Estonia, where I also served. The Estonians, goodness knows, they had reasons to be resentful about the fact that their great part of their country had been, well, in the first place, they had an enormous number of people, of their own people, deported, and Russians in on top of them. But the people keep forgetting that it was a communist regime who did these things. It was not the present regime. One of the things that I find I encounter all the time in the thinking of people, that they make now, 50 years later, no great difference. Russia was Russia all the same thing, whether it was Stalin's Russia or whether it was the old Russia. Well, this simply isn't true.
Yeah.
The two centuries the Baltic countries were under Russia, the difficulties developed only in the final years of those two centuries. Otherwise, things went reasonably well. And Riga, where I served there for two or three years, its most prosperous time and happiest time in history was still, where they were nominally Russia.
Yeah.
But when people have forgotten that it wasn't a Russian occupation.
Well, but you know, I think this is one of the great contributions of your life, the ability and the way you point out to us the need to revisit our assumptions, to think critically and challenge received wisdom at every point in the light of new circumstances,
yes.
Not to simply adhere to some rigid doctrine for all time.
Well, that's true. And mistakes were made on both sides all through the earlier centuries, too. I realize that. But the relations with Eastern Europe and Central Europe are much more complicated in the Tsarist period than we think about.
It's also auspicious that we sit and speak at this time, which is the fast approaching 25th anniversary of the Kennan Institute in Washington, D.C. You, of course, sir, were instrumental in the founding of that institute. And as you then remarked at the time of its founding, this is the only national institution devoted to Soviet studies. What kinds of initiatives would you like to see the Kennan Institute undertaking now in this very vastly changed international environment and state of U.S.-Russian relations?
Yes, I think that we ought to make every effort to meet them on the academic and cultural plane, even though there are great problems, questions, difficulties at the political level. Let us, for goodness sake, do keep some people who are deeply interested in Russia and who can go over there study, interchange ideas with people in Russia, and gain the respect. The Russians are very impressed when somebody abroad shows a knowledge of their culture. Real scholarship has almost a religious quality to it. It's a dedication. You have to love it, and you have to put other things aside when you do it. If the scholar does his job, does it honestly, imaginatively, but recognizing that his dedication is to the truth, and the truth not just in the factual dimension, but also in the intuitive and analytical dimension. If he does this, he's going to be useful to people beyond himself and beyond his colleagues. And if he loses that scholarly integrity, he's going to lose that usefulness. That's my feeling about the Kennan Institute.
I have to thank you. Those are wonderful words.
Yeah.
Not only eloquent, but indeed very wise, sir.
Very welcome.
Ambassador, I would love to, with your indulgence, sir, conclude this conversation, which has been absolutely marvelous, by asking you about wider interests of yours that have always fascinated me. And here, sir, I am speaking in terms of your interest in civilization, in the state of American society, in current issues like the environment, like nuclear proliferation, and with kind of the way we live today, the way we are, which for someone like yourself, sir, who I think has a deep understanding of literature and history, may not be the way we should be living. That is to say, a certain lack of civility or coarsening.
Well, you see here now at my age, and looking back on all of this, my life has been a life of this century. Well, looking at that, I find myself thinking more and more about our own country. And I think that the first things we have to do to ourselves here before we think about world authority or prestige or things like that. We are involved, of course, and we have to face these problems as they arise day by day. But what really worries me is about this country. And what worries me most is the whole question of the financing of elections. I think our whole ideal of an electoral country run by elections is being undermined by the role of money. And I realize that a Congress elected that way has a very short image or prediction into the future. It can think only about 6 months ahead, no more. And this won't do for our country. I tried to lay this out in the book I wrote about Around the Cragged Hill a few years ago. But I feel more and more strongly about this, that the greatest problems of this country are long-range ones, about the role of television with relation to education in this country, about the advertising profession, whether limits don't have to be put on this. These are very profound problems. Also, transportation, what the automobile has done to American society. Not that we can live entirely without it, but did it have to have the monopolistic control of all means of transportation, which essentially it has today outside of Washington, New York? Well, all these things worry me very greatly, and particularly because I find that they cannot be and are not being confronted by Congress, the National Congress. More attention is being given to them by some of the state governments, not all of them, but some of them, than being given at the national level. And for this reason, I have encouraged, where I could, the idea of a certain decentralization of power and authority in this country. This affects foreign affairs, too. It affects our relations with our neighbors, with the Canadians, with the Mexicans. And all of that preoccupies me a lot today. I really feel we're in deep, deep trouble. A country that lets, let us say, a commercial interest, the television interests, have the role, the educational role that they have in this country today, there's something very wrong here, and I'm not exaggerating, and everybody knows I'm not exaggerating. What these kids see sitting in the living room when their parents don't control them reaches them in a very emotionally and otherwise probably more than the school system does, and the very amount of time they spend on it. I mean, these are very dangerous evils in our country today. I think that people are beginning to react against them in encouraging ways, but in small pockets of our life. And you lack the leadership at the national level that would have to be taken, I think. I mean, these things worry me more than anything else. I've been engaged in these last months in an attempt to write a history of my own family. And I look at the people out of which the family, the ones that first came, the 18th century and the 19th. And I can't help but feel that a great deal has been lost.
Ambassador Kennan, I want to thank you very much for the, not just the eloquence of those words, but the message. I'm mindful as I sit before you that at an earlier point in my life was your student. I was your student, and I think I still remain your student.
Well, thank you.
I thank you very much for this lesson, sir.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for your attention, your curiosity to know what an old man is thinking.
Oh, dear.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Ambassador George F. Kennan. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed, and our technical director is John Tyler. Our production assistants are Kirsten LaCour-DeBelco and Andrea Bertone. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.